As with all of the stories I will tell, there is an element of shock and awe which can be expected when discussing the subject matter. This episode, however, is unlike any I have come across. The absolute horrific acts committed by these individuals had me debating whether to do this episode. Acts so horrific that this case, and its audio tape, is used by the FBI as a training tool to desensitize new agents and profilers to the lowest mankind has to offer. An audio tape of the rape and torture of a 16-year-old girl. While the audio hasn't been made public, the court transcripts are, and in true fashion, the story will be told as accurately as possible. This episode of The Serial Holic contains descriptions of disturbing graphic content which may be offensive to some people. Listener discretion is advised. Serial killers.
I'm not a big serial killer, by the way. Eight people, that's nothing.
Don't you dare touch me! Murder.
I wouldn't let me go, no.
Because you'd kill again.
More than positive.
Mystery. I'm Dave Jari, and I am the Serial Holic. Life was carefree in California during the year of 1977. Our country was still going through a sense of political and sexual revolution that was born in the 60s, and people were more open to all cultures of life. This was more apparent in the teenagers during this time. Still influenced by the summer of love, teens were experimenting in sex and drugs, where an invitation to drink beer or smoke weed was enough to earn yourself a new friend, however temporary it was. These teens were also naive to the real world, as this was the decade of the serial killer. The media was flooded with monikers like the Son of Sam, the Genesee River Killer, the Hillside Strangler, the Coed Killer, the Killer Clown, the Bedroom Basher, and BTK. In fact, the 1970s had well over 100 known serial killers through the U.S., and California was certainly a breeding ground. 1977 was also the year Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris sparked a partnership in the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. The prison wasn't segregated like it is today. In the 70s, medium and low security inmates were housed together, which is how Bittaker, a low-level thief, and Norris, served time after a series of sexual assaults, met in the first place. During their time in prison, they would develop a plan to rape, torture, and kill unsuspecting teens, and when they were released in 1978, the media would soon have a new moniker: the Toolbox Killers. Lawrence Bittaker was born in 1940 to a couple who had chosen not to have children. He was placed in an orphanage and was soon adopted. Bittaker moved often as a child and failed to develop any meaningful or lasting relationships with his peers. He first found himself on the wrong side of the law when he was caught shoplifting at the age of 12. He would go on to commit several other crimes and would be in and out of juvenile detention for a good part of his teen years. He would later claim that his criminal behavior was a call for attention, as he felt he lacked love as a child. Bittaker would find school boring and tedious and dropped out at the age of 17. It would later be discovered that he had an IQ of 138, which would explain why he didn't feel challenged in his schoolwork. After he dropped out, he committed several other offenses, which would include car theft, hit and run, and evading arrest. He was sent to the California Youth Authority until the age of 18, and upon his release, he discovered that his adoptive family had moved to another state. He would never see them again. Roy Norris was born in Greeley, Colorado in 1948. His parents, who had not intended to conceive him, were forced into marriage to avoid the social stigma of the time. His father worked in a scrapyard, and his mother, a drug addict, was unemployed. From the moment of his birth, it was evident that his parents didn't want him. He was neglected often and would bounce between living with his parents and foster homes throughout his childhood. He would recall his experiences from his time spent in foster homes. and would describe years of being denied sufficient food and clothing, and in one instance, sexual abuse. While visiting a family member when he was 16, he made sexual advances towards her. She reported this event to his father, and in turn, became violent with Norris. He stole his father's car and drove to the Rocky Mountains to kill himself by injecting air into his veins. He failed. He was later apprehended as a runaway and placed back into the care of his parents, who abruptly informed him that he was no longer wanted. He dropped out of school and joined the Navy in 1965 and deployed to Vietnam in 1969. During his tour, he would experiment with heroin and marijuana and was discharged from the Navy after he was accused and arrested for several sexual assaults. The paths of Lawrence Whittaker and Roy Norris were profoundly different, but would remain parallel leading up to their fateful meeting. Whittaker was in and out of prison since being released from juvenile detention, mostly for shoplifting and car theft. What would bring him to the California Men's Colony was after he stabbed a supermarket employee who accused him of shoplifting. Meanwhile, Norris was in and out of prison and mental institutions for a variety of sexual misconducts ranging from assault to rape. In 1970, he was sentenced to Atascadero State Hospital for the criminally insane and released in 1975 after doctors claimed he was no longer a risk to society. If you recall from episode 1, Ed Kemper was also deemed no longer a risk from this very hospital. It goes to show the lack of understanding people had for mental illness in the 60s and 70s. Norris would go on to rape again, and in this time, he was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon after he repeatedly struck his victim in the head with a large rock. For this, he was sent to the California Men's Colony. Whittaker and Norris weren't really close at first, as Whittaker tended to keep to himself, and Norris was involved with the biker gangs and also sold drugs while in prison. They became acquainted during some free time when Norris showed Whittaker how to make jewelry. Their relationship was solidified when Whittaker saved Norris on two occasions. Both instances were the result of Norris being attacked. The two became inseparable, and Norris would brag to him about his sexual exploits. Intrigued, Whittaker divulged some of his own fantasies, claiming if he ever raped a woman, he would kill them so there wouldn't be any witnesses. These talks fueled the hunger inside Whittaker, and fate was set. The two began to lay out a plan that upon release, they would kidnap, rape, torture, and kill girls in the age range of 13 to 19, with the ultimate goal of at least one from each age. Whittaker was released in October of 1978 and found a job as a machinist making $1,000 per week, which would be close to $3,800 per week in today's inflation. Self-described as a loner, he would become popular in his neighborhood as being a generous man who donated money to the Salvation Army and would buy large amounts of fast food and deliver it to the homeless. He was also popular with the teenagers as he would always have an endless supply of alcohol and weed. Norris was released in January of 1979. He moved in with his mother and found work as an electrician. Shortly after his release, Norris received a letter from Whittaker to rekindle their plans, and the two met in February. At this meeting, they discussed a number of things, including the type of vehicle they should drive. They decided on purchasing a silver 1977 GMC cargo van. It was windowless, and the sliding side door would make it easier to pull up on their victims and kidnap them. They both put their money together and purchased the van, which Whittaker would name the Murder Mac. They would customize the inside with a makeshift bed, a cooler for alcohol to tempt teenagers to come inside for a drink, and a toolbox. Whittaker and Norris wouldn't start their plan right away. They had homework to do. From April to June, they would cruise the beaches and highways picking up teenage girls, party with them, and then let them go without leaving a scratch. This was just for practice. They had to hone their skills, and they were quite successful with their laid-back, good-time approach, and of course, their alcohol and weed. They also needed a place to commit their crimes and dispose of the bodies. They found this location in an abandoned, secluded fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains. Whittaker broke off the old rusty lock on the gate to the fire road with a crowbar and replaced it with a lock that he owned. They were now ready. On June 24th, 1979, 16-year-old Lucinda Schaefer was attending a youth group meeting at her Presbyterian church. At around 7:30 p.m., the meeting concluded, and Lucinda was walking back to her grandmother's house when Whittaker spotted the young teen. He pointed her out to Norris by saying, "There's a cute little blonde." They pulled over and made several attempts to have her enter the van, first by offering her a ride, then by offering her weed and alcohol. The ruse that they had practiced for months didn't work on Lucinda. Being a devoted Presbyterian, declined all of their requests. But this didn't sway Bittaker and Norris. They drove a short distance up the road and pulled to the side. Norris opened the sliding door and hopped out. With his head and shoulders inside the van, they waited as Lucinda passed by. Norris made his move and grabbed her, dragging her into the van. He then bound her arms and legs and gagged her with duct tape. At first she was screaming, so Bittaker turned the volume up on the radio to drown out her pleas for help. Bittaker would later say that soon after her kidnapping, Lucinda displayed a magnificent state of self-control and composed acceptance of the conditions of which she had no control. She shed no tears, offered no resistance, and expressed no great concern for her safety. When they reached the fire road, Norris told Bittaker to take a walk for an hour and savagely raped her. When Bittaker returned, it was his turn to rape her as Norris took a walk. Norris returned and raped her again. Both would later pin the murder of Lucinda on each other, but according to court documents, it was Norris who made the first attempt. Lucinda, in a manner of acceptance of her fate, asked Norris for a moment of prayer before they would take her life. He proceeded to strangle Lucinda, and after the look in her eyes, he released and jumped out of the van to vomit. Bittaker quickly took over and stopped after Lucinda began convulsing. He then wrapped a coat hanger around her neck and twisted it with a pair of pliers he retrieved from the toolbox. Lucinda was dead, and denied of her wish to have a moment with her lord. They wrapped her in a shower curtain and threw her over a cliff into a canyon. Norris, worried that someone would find her, was assured by Bittaker that the animals will eat her up.
What's good, everybody? This is Dave. I'd like to invite you to become a Serialholic by joining Patreon. Lots of great perks are available, including a free gift, exclusive chat group, monthly AMAs, and much more depending on the tier you select. Join me now by going to patreon.com/theserialholic. That's patreon.com/theserialholic. Thank you all for your continued support. Now back to the episode.
Andrea Joy Hall grew up in Akron, Ohio. She had moved to Los Angeles in February of 1978, and she wrote her family often. She had been unable to find work in her new town and made whatever money she could by donating her blood. 2 weeks after Lucinda's murder, on July 8, 1979, Bittaker and Norris spotted the 18-year-old, who was hitchhiking on the Pacific Coast Highway. They began to slow down to offer her a ride when another vehicle moved in to pick her up. Andrea entered that vehicle and they took off. Angered and determined, Bittaker and Norris followed the vehicle to Redondo Beach, where she got out of the car. Andrea still needed a ride, however, and this deadly duo were more than happy to offer her one. Norris moved to the back of the van, so it appeared that Bittaker was alone. They pulled up alongside of Andrea, and Bittaker offered her a ride. She accepted. Being that it was a hot July day, Bittaker offered Andrea a cold drink from the cooler in the back. As she got up to go retrieve it, Norris pounced. She put up quite a fight, as Norris recalls, but he was able to subdue her by twisting her arm behind her back as she screamed in pain. Norris then gagged her and bound her wrists and ankles. The pair drove Andrea to the killing ground in the San Gabriel Mountains. This time, it was Bittaker who raped her twice, and Norris once. During Bittaker's second assault at Andrea, Norris thought he saw headlights. Bittaker covered Andrea's mouth and dragged her into a nearby bush as Norris went in search of the alleged vehicle. When he returned, the three traveled deeper into the mountains. Andrea, naked, was forced up a hill where Bittaker made her perform oral sex on him and told her to pose for pictures that he took with his Polaroid camera. Then they drove to a third location, and again, Bittaker forced Andrea up another hill as Norris went to the store to buy alcohol. When Norris returned from the store, Andrea was nowhere to be found. Bittaker produced two additional pictures of Andrea, both of which expressed absolute terror on her face. Bittaker explained to Norris that he made Andrea beg for her life and give him reasons not to kill her. As Andrea pleaded, Bittaker shoved an ice pick through her ear and into her brain. Laying on the ground and still alive, he turned her over and shoved the ice pick through the other ear, this time stomping it into her head until the handle broke off. Bittaker then strangled her and threw her over a cliff. Then, on September 3, 1979, Bittaker and Norris were traveling along the Pacific Coast Highway where they came across two young girls sitting at a bus stop. 15-year-old Jackie Gilliam and 13-year-old Jacqueline Lamp had been walking and hitchhiking when they stopped at the bus stop near Hermosa Beach to sit on a bench and rest. They pulled up alongside the girls and offered them a ride. Once in the van, Norris brought out some marijuana and the four smoked for a while until the girls noticed they were no longer on the PCH. They made it known that they wanted out of the van as Bittaker and Norris both came up with excuses as to why they were heading to the San Gabriel Mountains. These girls could not be fooled. Jacqueline attempted to open the sliding door, and as she did, Norris hit her in the back of the head with a bag filled with lead weights, knocking her unconscious. He then attacked Jackie and began to gag and bind her. Jacqueline woke up and again made an attempt for the door. She succeeded, though temporarily. Norris jumped out, grabbed her, and pulled her back into the van. Bittaker, aware that all of this occurred where there could have been witnesses, parked the van in a secluded area. He jumped in the back, punched Jackie in the face, and assisted Norris in tying up Jacqueline. Bittaker continued on their journey to the San Gabriel Mountains, where over the course of 2 days, they repeatedly raped, beat, and tortured the girls, with Jackie receiving the brunt of the abuse. They took turns sleeping in the van with the girls while the other was lookout. Bittaker would take several pictures of Gilliam, both with clothes and without, and even took pictures of Norris as he lay naked with her. For his part, Norris would take pornographic pictures of Jacqueline. Now, this is the first known instance in which Bittaker brought out an audio recorder while he was raping Jackie. He forced Jackie to pretend that she was his cousin and encouraged her to scream out in pain. He also tortured Jackie by stabbing her breasts with an ice pick and tearing off her nipples with a pair of pliers. After 2 days of rape and torture, the end had come for Jackie and Jacqueline. Jackie was pulled out of the van and stabbed in each ear with an ice pick and then strangled. With Jackie dead, Jacqueline was dragged out. Defiant to the end, she was beaten over the head with a sledgehammer by Norris. Thought to be dead, Jacqueline opened her eyes and gasped. Norris continued to bludgeon her head with the sledgehammer as Bittaker strangled her. They were both thrown over an embankment, and Bittaker would take the audio recording of his raping of Jackie and bury it in a cemetery. That recording has never been found. On October 31, 1979, 16-year-old Shirley Ledford had attended a friend's Halloween party in a suburb of Los Angeles. She walked to a nearby gas station looking for a ride home when a familiar face approached. What could be assumed as a cordial greeting took place as Shirley stood there talking with Lawrence Bittaker. Lawrence and Shirley knew each other, with Shirley working part-time as a waitress at the restaurant Bittaker would often frequent. Also remember, Bittaker was popular in these parts, especially with the teenagers. With an offer to take her home, Shirley entered the van. While Norris was distracting Shirley with an offer to smoke weed, Bittaker pulled down a secluded street. Norris jumped Shirley and held a knife to her as he bound and gagged her with duct tape. Bittaker and Norris switched places, and Norris began driving aimlessly around town as Bittaker tormented Shirley in the back of the van. It was then that Bittaker instructed Norris to turn on the tape recorder. Norris traded places with Bittaker as Shirley lay crying and moaning in the back of the van. With Shirley's genitals and rectum viciously torn by the pliers, Norris couldn't rape her. However, he did force the already agonized girl to perform oral sex. Once he climaxed, he switched on the tape and recorded himself. After over 2 hours of rape and torture, Norris wrapped a coat hanger around Shirley's neck and twisted it with pliers. They later claimed that Shirley didn't put up much of a fight as she died. In a final act of complete disrespect, they decided rather than bring her body to their usual dumping grounds, they would leave her body for all to see. They selected a random house and placed her in an ivy bed, naked, with her arms and legs spread open. She was found by a jogger the next morning. In all, Shirley's injuries were so severe, the medical examiner had a difficult time determining which injury was the cause of death, ultimately declaring she had died from strangulation. In addition to the signs of rape, her injuries include blunt force trauma to the head, face, and breasts. She had puncture wounds to her breasts and deep lacerations to her fingers. Her elbow sustained multiple fractures as Norris hit her elbow with the sledgehammer well over 25 times. Her clitoris, labia, vulva, vagina, and rectum all had numerous tears caused by the pliers used by Bittaker. To this point, Shirley was the only victim that has been found. Over the next month, Norris reacquainted himself with a former friend from the California men's colony, Joseph Jackson. He would brag about the rapes and murder that he and Bittaker had done, including a rape they committed in September, but she had escaped. Obviously disturbed, Jackson would report this information to his attorney, who advised him to go to the police. When speaking to detectives, Jackson would give them numerous facts about the cases, including how Lucinda had left a shoe behind when she was kidnapped. But the one that stood out to them was a silver van. The victim who had escaped Robin Robeck, couldn't provide much information, as she was sprayed with pepper spray when she was abducted. Robeck, who had come from Oregon to visit family at the time of her abduction and rape, had given one clear description. They drove a silver van. Police traveled to Oregon with a lineup, and Robin pointed out Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris as her assailants. Surveillance was placed on Norris, and when he was witnessed selling marijuana, a violation of his parole, he was arrested. Police also went to Bittaker's motel room and brought him in for questioning. At first, both men denied the allegations, but when detectives told Norris he would be charged with rape and murder and face the death penalty, he sang like a bird. Upon Norris's confession, police obtained search warrants for both of their homes in the silver van. In Norris's home, they found Shirley Ledford's bracelet and nearly 500 Polaroid pictures of girls at Redondo and Hermosa Beach, as well as Burbank High School. Inside Bittaker's home, detectives found the photographs he had taken of Andrea Hall and Jackie Gilliam, along with numerous bottles of acid that he was to use in their next abduction. Inside the van, they found a sledgehammer, pliers, and numerous other tools, a bag filled with lead weights, a jar of Vaseline, necklaces belonging to two of the victims, and the recording of the rape and torture of Shirley Ledford. In what can only be described as something worse than a nightmare, Shirley's mother had to listen to the recording in order to identify her daughter's voice. With evidence mounting against both men, Norris agreed to cooperate, with the promise prosecutors wouldn't pursue the death penalty. Norris led them to the locations he believed the bodies were dumped. They found the skeletal remains of Jackie Gilliam and Jacqueline Lamp scattered over a vast area by wild animals. Lucinda Schaefer and Andrea Hall have never been found. Police had the daunting task of identifying the girls in the pictures found in their homes and in the van. Police scoured the beaches, schools, and local area and compared them with missing persons. They were able to identify nearly all of the girls in the pictures and mark them safe. All except 19. 19 additional teenage girls had crossed paths with Bittaker and Norris, never to be seen again. Bittaker was eventually tried and convicted for the murders of Lucinda Schaefer, Andrea Hall, Jackie Gilliam, Jacqueline Lamp, and Shirley Ledford. He received the death penalty. For Norris's cooperation, prosecutors petitioned the court for life in prison. In a decision that would shock the victims' families and the surrounding community, the judge sentenced Norris to 45 years to life. Norris is up for parole in 2019. This episode of The Serial Holic was written and produced by me, Dave Jari. As always, stay tuned for more episodes, and thank you for listening.